I am an alcoholic, and my name's Buck Melton. Hi, everybody. I got to retell that story. It's different. I'm going to try to do the best I can and not use no barnyard talk up here tonight. It's good to be back at Montego. You know, I believe if I could stay here on this mountain with you people all the time, I wouldn't have no trouble. It's just, I've enjoyed every minute since I've been here. I really have. And I thank you for inviting us back down here. And it's just good to be here. And I've enjoyed it so far. And that wife of mine, I thought, did a good job this morning. I didn't start off to get her applause, you know. a little old thing about Al-Anon's, it's going around up in our part, and she's unjoined it, I think. I'm just making fun. I love Al-Anon. But, you know, they got a new deal going in there. It's the only requirement to become a member of Al-Anon is a desire just not to have sex. And she joined that outfit. But you know, when you get out and rambling around the country, a lot of things happen. And, yeah, we left home last Monday and been on the road all week. And you know, if they do and enjoy it, they have to go back and pick up a chip. And by God, she's going to get her a chip next Thursday. That's. I want a plate, and she's done broke it. No, I just want a little fun, and thank God for both programs, for AA and Al-Anon. If it hadn't been for Al-Anon, we would have split a long time ago. There's no doubt about that. But I'm not here to tell her story or rebuttal anything she said. I'm just glad she's a member of that fellowship. And I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I haven't had a drink in 2 days, 2 months, and 24 years, by the grace of God, and because this program works one day at a time for me. Thank you. And folks, I was ready when I got here. I'll tell you, I knew the day I come I was an alcoholic, and 2 days before that, there was no way nobody could have convinced me. I just immediately become one, but I had worked for 26 years to get there. You know, hell, and I'm an alcoholic, and that's all you're going to hear me talk about. You know, I ain't, they can't call me Martha White, for I ain't never put nothing but my finger in my nose, I'm just an alcoholic, and that's what... I'm going to talk about what it was like, what happened to me, and how it is today. And I hope I can do it in that order. But there's some people here that come, one lady that come from the county I was born and raised in. And I was born on a cotton farm in a little Union County, North Carolina. And this time of the year, back when I was coming up, and Virginia mentioned that depression, that was a real depression that I come up in. You couldn't see nothing but white fields. Hell, ain't a bowl of cotton in that county now. But you know, I was one of seven. There's six boys and one girl. And I was next to the last one. And by the time them overhauls got down to me, there was patches on them. And they was wore out and strung out and wasn't no pockets in them. I ain't had nothing to put in it. No way, but you know. We were poor folks, and I knew we were poor. But we was a good family. My dad had bought this big old farm down there, and right next to a high school and to a Methodist church. And he wanted his boys to get a good education, but my dad never did get an education. And so we worked hard in the fields, and on Wednesday and Sunday we went to church. Every time those doors opened. My dad was not a church. He was a good man, but he wasn't a church man. But my mother believed in getting them boys to church, and we went too. But you know, when you work in a cotton field all day, it's good to get out and go anywhere. Yeah, they said they had some water up here. Speaker's supposed to take a sip every once in a while. I feel good tonight. It's going to be a good time. And I got my wife sitting over here on my blind side, you know. I could have y'all all crying a little bit, but don't stay in AA too long if you don't want to change. And you know, I come in here, I had a mouth full of teeth, a head full of hair, and hell, I could see. And now I'm about blind, bald-headed, and have my teeth gone. But that's what happens when you when you run them beer joints for years, and people, oh, they forget about you after a while, but they don't forget quick. We went to church, and it was a good life where I come up. It really was, and I still go back down in the country there a while. And I want to say this. My mother saw me 14 years in the program, sober. And for that, I'm grateful. But all my brothers got a good education, my sister, and everything was going good. And I don't know what happened. When I was 15 and a half years old, I just decided to run away from home. And I left, buddy. I never did have no trouble drinking in college or high school, either one. But I quit. And I got off of that Trailway bus in Charlotte. And I went down the street and found me a little room. And I was kidding a feller today, had on them overalls. I went down there and I got this little room and I got rid of my blue bib overalls, and I ain't putting none on since then, folks. And I got my little pants on, and I went up the street, and right in front of the old Southern Depot there in Charlotte, there was a little cafe. And I went in there and asked the man for a job. And he said, well, son, said, I need somebody, but you have to be 16 to work here. Well, see, I wasn't 15 and a half, and I didn't even have to think. I think us alkies are born liars. I said, I'm 16 and a half. Didn't bat an eye. He said, you go over and get your worker's permit and come on back, and I'll put you to work at 3 o'clock this evening. And I said, okay. And on the way over there, I got to thinking, you know, here I am on my own today, and I've already told a lie. And I knew, you know, I knew better, and it started bothering me. But I went on in and got permit and started back down the cafe, and I got to thinking, man, I hadn't ought to told that lie. And it did bother me. It never did bother me enough to tell the truth, I can tell you that. But I went on back that evening at 3 o'clock. I went to work with an old boy that in 1959, you probably read about it, he was on his sixth honeymoon, and he fell out of an airplane. He was going from Charlotte to Asheville, and I don't know why I get on these airplane people, you know, hell, these pilots can get up there and just drive and fly like hell drunk, but you can't even smoke in one of them anymore. But you can't open an airplane door now, but in 1959, Pruitt was drunk. He was a good man, and he was drunk, and he thought he was pulling a lever to go into the bathroom, and he pulled it, and that door cracked and just sucked him right out, and he landed in the cemetery over in Shelby, North Carolina, and that's where his tombstone is. They didn't have to dig no hole for Pruitt, but I went on back, and I went to work with that Pruitt that evening, and I liked him. Everybody liked him. He got along good with everybody, and the women, they were just crazy about old Pruitt. And that night at 12 o'clock when they closed the shop, Pruitt said, Buck, would you like a drink? And I said, man, I sure would. And I thought he was going to bring me a Pepsi Cola. And he come back in that kitchen, and he had a pint of liquor and two glasses and a Coca-Cola. And he took the top off of that bottle and handed me the bottle, and the two tumblers were sitting there, and he said, go ahead and pour you a drink. Well, you know, I just turned the bottle up and I poured a tumbler half full. And he was looking at me and he said, don't you want some Coke in it? And I said, no, I drank mine like this. So you know I never had drank no liquor. And I picked up that glass of whiskey and turned it up, and I took about two swallers and I sneezed. And when I did, the liquor come out of my ears, nose, and eyes. And it really messed me up. They took me on down to my little room that night, and the next morning I got up and I walked the streets of Charlotte. Now, when you come from a place called Prospect down in Union County, the biggest thing I had seen was a barn. And so I was excited about being in Charlotte, and I got out and walked the streets there in Charlotte and looked the town over. And at 3 o'clock the next evening, I was back in the place. And it was, what did I say, it was right across from the old Southern Depot. And a lot of taxis parked right in beside the little restaurant. And these cab drivers come in, got to picking at me about, oh, I done had me a drink of liquor, you know. And they had fun out of me. And it was all right. It was good for me. And so that night when they closed the shop at midnight, old Frank Sims said, Buck, won't you come ride with me? And said, I'll show you this town. I said, okay. So went out there and got in that taxi, and he made a couple of pickup and deliveries, and we pulled in a little place down on Mint Street. And there's a lot of young people in here that today don't know about dry counties. And there wasn't no liquor stores in North Carolina in 1948. And so you had to buy all your brown liquor, which is store-bought liquor, from the bootleggers. And so we pulled in there that night, and I said, what are we going to do? And he said, oh, we're going to get us a little drink of liquor. I said, okay. Well, I'd learned one thing the night before, that you put a whole lot of Coke and a little bit of liquor in the glass. And so we had us a little drink, and a few minutes we was talking, and we had another drink, and he said, let's go pick up some women. Now, I'd done had two drinks of liquor, and I'd have tackled a tackle right there. And so, sure enough, I'd been in Charlotte 2 days and done experienced liquor and women, and I've always said, hell, either one of them could kill me. And damn, almost did before I got to AA. But that's the way my drinking started off. And, you know, I drank for a long time, and I had some good days drinking. All my time wasn't bad, folks. I had some good times and good experiences, and hell, I learned to just about live on nothing and keep getting along. And so the World War II come along, and I wasn't brave. They drafted me. And I went in, and I served my time, and I really believe I was a good soldier. If I was afraid to get too drunk. Now, I drank a little bit, but I never would get drunk while I was on duty. And so I was a good soldier, and when the war was over, I was in a little old hospital there right in Paris, France. And they I was in the hospital, and they orders come through, said, you're going to fly back to the States. And we're going to send me back to my outfit on a Monday. And I didn't smoke, but I got a carton of cigarettes a week. My brother was sending me a carton a week. And I had more money than I knew what to do with. So I just went and checked into a hotel. And I stayed there for a week and drank and had fun. Now, this wasn't alcoholic drinking, folks. I know what I was doing there. And the next Monday, I decided, well, I'm going to go back and check in my outfit. And maybe they'll give me about 6 months punishment right here in Paris. And I'll be all right if I ain't have nothing to hurry back home for. But I went and checked in with my outfit. And at 10 o'clock that morning, they had me on a plane headed back for Fort Bragg, North Carolina. And so I come back into Fort Bragg and discharged. And my mother and dad were both still living down the country there. And so I went back home and got in that evening. I sure wasn't drinking. I never went to my mother and dad's house drinking as long as in my worst days I wouldn't go there. And I used to say I was afraid to, but I really wasn't. I had too much respect for those people. And so I spent the night there, and the next morning we got up and had breakfast, and I said to my mama, I said, and Dad, I said, well, I'm going to go back to Charlotte and see if I got a job. Well, I knew I had a job. And so when I got back to Charlotte, I went down, got my little room, and stopped by the place I had worked at. And they wanted to know if I was out, and I said, yeah, and they wanted me to go to work that evening. Well, you know, I was ready to go. And so I went on in to work that evening, and I met my excuse for the next 20 years of drinking right that day. And that's her sitting over there, you know. We've been married for 45 years now, and God, I don't know, we fell in love and everything, and you know, people wondered how you stay together for 45 years. There's two things that keeps me and that woman together. She's got one of them, and I got the other one. And I walked that little she walked that little cafe that night, and y'all wouldn't believe that was a good, yeah, you would believe it too. She ain't a bad looking woman now, but she was a pretty gal, old tall, lanky gal, you know, and I kind of like them tall gals anyway. But she turned me on that night. And after a while, she left, and the telephone rang, and she wanted to know if I'd take her home. And I said, yeah. And she said, well, you don't even know who this is. I said, yeah, you're that old tall gal that was in here a few minutes ago. And I said, where are you at? And she said, I'm at home. And she told me where she lived. I said, I'll be down there just as quick as I get out, close the shop. And so I went down to her place, and you know, they wrote a song about courting in the swing. She wouldn't let me in the house, and we courted in the swing that night out on the front porch. And so the next day she come out of the place and wanted to know where we were going out. And I said, no. I said, I do some drinking. And I knew every bootlegger in that town, and I liked the cab drivers. And I said, I'm going to go out and do some drinking tonight, and I'll talk to you tomorrow or later. And she said, okay. And I went ahead and worked that night, and at 12 o'clock I was closing the shop, and I started to put the lock in the door, and I looked, and she had parked as close to me here to the wall of the front door. And I thought, well, damn, did she not hear what I said? You know? I thought maybe she had a hearing problem. And so I said, well, I will step over and tell her that I'm fixing to go do some drinking. And I walked over to the car, and I looked in, and there was 12 old long necks sitting up on the front seat right beside her. And I think I knew right then I was going to marry that woman. And I crawled in, and away we went. And we drank and had fun, and things went good. We were married within a year and bought us a house, and our first daughter come along, and another year, another girl come along, and we were really happy. And, you know, things were going good. I wasn't making no money, didn't need none. And I still think today, you see these young people, we worry about them, you know, how they're going to make it. Hell, they're going to get along all right. Two young people in love, you can give them a bottle, box of cornflakes and a mattress, and they're going to make it, I'll guarantee you. and I better take this watch off. And things did. They went good, and we didn't have no problem. You know, I wasn't no alcoholic, and I was just, what little bit of drinking I'd done, I was enjoying it. And there'd be three or four couples, all of us veterans, just out of service, and we, on a Saturday night, we'd might buy a quart for three couples. You know, you ain't gonna get no trouble drinking liquor that way. And so it just rocked along, and everything was going good, and we went into business for ourselves in South Carolina, and God, I joined every club in that town. See, when I never had no money, and when you ain't never had no money and get a little bit, it seems like a lot. So I just went crazy. And looking back, I can tell within 6 months of the time I crossed over from just drinking till I was a compulsive drinker. I mean, I was in trouble quick. I joined all the clubs, and she was running the business. And back then, right after the war, we had good, dependable help. And I didn't have to worry about the business, and hell, I just hit the road. And she was doing good, and she did feel them part of that, and she was doing a good job. And I'd tell her every time I come back to get something. You know? and everything was going good. And I remember one night I met this guy. We were sitting out there, and I was into gambling. I wasn't making no money. I was losing it. And I was sitting there one night, and this boy, we got to talking, and he said, I've been watching you tonight. And I said, I've been watching you too. You know, crooks like crooks, sick people like sick people. And so I said, I've been watching you too. And he said, if we get together, we can make some money, Buck. And I said, when you want to start? He said, how about in the morning? And I said, okay. And we got together, and we started handling cards, and he was teaching me some real good tricks. And we got good at it, and we hit the road. And, you know, I got to where we'd practice. It's like we were going to the mill to go to work every morning. We'd get together and handle them cards. And I got so good, I'd get in front of the mirror and see if I could catch myself. Now, folks, you're getting damn good when you do that. And I was talking to a feller in here tonight, and we was talking about dice. And I could take a set of dice, and I could shake them things, sound like bones rattling all over the place. I'd hit that wall over here, and they'd come back over here. They'd never turn over. You know, if I had 11 up, there's 11 going to be up when they quit running. And I got good at this, and I just rambled. And that's when, on one of these trips back home, and I'd always come back check on Virginia. And I hear people say that alcoholics don't love the family. That's a lie. I don't care where I was at. I always thought about my family. and this young last daughter, when Virginia was pregnant with her, and come back, and she told me she was going to have to go home. And I felt bad about that. I said, you get your things together and get out of here, and I'll see you tonight when I close the shop. And that night I went home, and I was going to quit drinking, and I didn't take a drink that day from about 12 o'clock till closing time at midnight. And I went home, took a shower, and went to bed, and I couldn't sleep. And I didn't know that I needed a drink of liquor. I was just going to quit forever. And I was about to fly apart. The next morning I got up and put my clothes on, went back out and opened this business up. And, you know, up until this time, I'd always thought pretty good of myself. And I thought, hell, you know, life ain't worth it. And about up in the morning, I closed the place, run the people out, and I closed the place. And I sat down and even wrote a note. I don't know why I done that. I meant business, and I think I was serious as any human being could be. And I went back in that stock room with a .38 in my hand, and I really think it, you know, by God's grace, it's the only reason I'm here. I believe that. And there was a quart of gin sitting there on the stock shelf, and I jerked the top off of that bottle of gin, and I drank every swallow I could get down. And you know, I don't know how long it was, a few minutes. I thought, wasn't that the craziest damn thing you ever thought about? And from that day till I come to Alcoholics Anonymous, I never did quit drinking but one more time. Opened the place back up, tried to run it, and I couldn't. I was just staying drunk. And the day she went, I took her to the hospital drunk and forgot to go back and get her. That still bothers me. I mean, it does. And she come home in an ambulance. And I had a brother who was working in a service station there in that town. And I asked him if he'd like to have this business. And I mean, it was a good business, folks. We were making money. And this was back in the 50s. We was paying taxes on $75,000 and $80,000 a year plus what I was stealing. And that's a hell of a bunch of money. And down in our part of the country, it is. And we were doing good, but I had this brother who was working at the service station. He said, man, he'd love to have it. And I put him in business, and within a year, he paid us off, and he had him a place in Florida and one back in the Carolinas, driving that big, long, white Cadillac, and I resented the hell out of him. I said, it ought to have been mine. And it was mine. I drank it up, you know. And he done well, and thank goodness. And I'd get me, from this time on, I'd get me an old service station bill, and I'd put me a drink box out front and a dice table and a poker table in the back and selling liquor out the back door too. And me and this sheriff had, and they even tried to get me to run for sheriff in that county at one time. But, and me and the sheriff had drank together. We was good buddies. And he come out there one day and at this place, he knew I was selling liquor and running the games in the back room. And he come out one day and he called me out and I walked out there and he said, Buck, said, we got a federal man in town and said he's looking for people selling liquor. He said, now, I know that don't concern you, but just thought I'd tell you about it. And he drove off. About 2 hours later, him and the federal man back out there. I done sold him 2 jugs. And, you know, people always wanted to help me, and I wouldn't let them. And so I just, things got worse and worse. One of the clubs I'd hung out at, they needed somebody to run the bar and the game room. Now, that's a dandy job for somebody like me. And so I took the job, and I made these people some money, too. I really did. You can't help but make money when you're stealing and cutting the pot, too. And I done very well for them. I woke up out there one Sunday morning, sick and hungover, and I called Virginia and asked her if she'd come out. And she said she'd be there in a little bit. And I called the manager of the club, and he got out there. He said, what's going on? And I said, the people's hanging around this club is causing me to drink, and I'm going to get the hell away from them. And, you know, nobody never helped me and poured a drink in me. But he tried to get me, said, Buck, take off some time and do whatever it takes to get yourself straightened out. We'll pay you and come on back. Said, you've made a lot of money for us. I said, no, I'm checking out. And I did. And that's the next time I got sober in about 3 or 4 weeks and laying around the house there and souped up good. And I told Virginia one day, I got to thinking, that's good for a suffering alcoholic to think too much. But I said, you know, if we'd go down on Main Street and open up a real nice restaurant, we wouldn't serve beer and wouldn't serve wine and I wouldn't drink, and we'd get all these church people come doing business with us. Now, when you done been in their jails for bootlegging, fighting and gambling and drug out of places and expect the church people come do business with you, I'll be damned if you won't starve to death, folks. I didn't do no business, but I had a pretty place there. A nice restaurant. And I went to open that thing up. That's when I left that 1st of October. I went to open it up one morning. I just said, to hell with it. I hung a lock back and locked her up and went to the liquor store. And I had sold this business in the pool room down there for $1,000, and I'd paid more than that for the little sign that was hanging over the door. And I mean, it was fully equipment, stocked, and everything. But that's what we'll do for a drink of liquor. And you know, I seem to hear people say, oh, I wouldn't sell my shoes. Hell, you'll do anything if you get to hurting bad enough. And I sold that place of business for $1,000 and went to a little flop house across the river and stayed drunk to my money. You know, I had a lot of buddies when I had that money buying liquor. And the man that run the motel, he come back there and he drank my free liquor too. But on Christmas, Christmas Eve, he come back to get his rent and I was broke. And he said, you get the hell out of here. Well, that's the reason I got home for Christmas, 1958. I pulled up there broke and sick and hungover, and Virginia was afraid I was going to be mad. And if you don't think this is a family illness, I'm damned, you look them over. That woman was afraid I was going to be fussing. I hadn't been home since October. And she said I could go to Charlotte with her. And I said, well, you got the bed loaded? And she said, yeah. I said, let's go. And so that's the way we ended up, moving back to Charlotte Christmas Eve of 1958. Now, if you see somebody moving on the 4th of July or Thanksgiving or Christmas, you can bet you there's a problem somewhere, folks. That ain't no good time to move, I can tell you that. And we got back up there, and there was no power on and no water. And the neighbor saw, I think, what was going on. And then she had a man when she come back, too. I don't think she'd included that in the rent. So they didn't know what was going on, but they brought a water hose over and brought some candles. And they went back and got some fruit and things for the kids. And when you come from Union County, to me, that was charity. And by God, and I didn't like it. But I didn't say anything. And I'm glad that I didn't. But they had a right good Christmas. And I thought then, well, you know, Monday I'll go down and I'll find me a job. I'll go back to this place I'd worked at and ask the man for a job. But I knew that I was in bad trouble then. And on the way down to see him about a job, I thought, you know, he knows I'm a drunk. And he won't hire me, and I wouldn't even go ask him. I went out and I took a job pushing the wheelbar for a brick contractor. 1959, you people that worked outside in 59, it was cold. And I mean, it was cold, but I mixed mortar and hauled bricks, and they paid me $1 an hour. 3 years prior to this, we paid taxes on better than $85,000 that year. Now that's coming down the ladder in one hell of a hurry. And while I was working on this job, there was some mornings I'd get up to go to work and there wasn't no money at the house to buy nothing with. And get out there and it wasn't, the brick contractor's too cold for them to work. And I didn't have nothing to drink. And I never had drank nothing but from the top of the shelf up until this time. And I found a little substitute called terpene hydrate with codeine in it. And if I don't live much over 100, I hadn't ought to never cough again. I drank enough of that stuff that winter that if I'd get pneumonia, I don't believe I'd cough. But it done the same thing for me that VO and Canadian Club done. It done the same trick. Now, I don't recommend nobody to get it, but if I'd ever, praise God, I hope I never start back, but if I ever did, it'd do the same thing for me that anything else did. And I drank it. And one day there's an old boy I was working with. He said, Buck, said there's a little restaurant down here. Well, it was a little old beer joint down here on the river for sale. Said, you've been in the restaurant and lounge business. You ought to go down there and look the place over. I said, man, I ain't got $10 to my name. And that was all was said about it. And we went ahead and worked that day. And the man that I worked for, now he worked drunks. For he paid you off every evening. When you got paid you 8 hours, he'd give you $8. And so we got that $8, went out, and we had us two or three drinks and got to talking. And, hell, I got to feeling good. I got rich quick. I told him, I said, let's go down there. I'll just buy that place. So we got in the car, and sure enough, we went down there and looked the place over, and two brothers owned it. And they told me what they'd take for it, and it was a pretty good-looking little old beer joint. And I told him, I said, I'll be back in the morning with the cash and buy this thing. He said, well, if you do, you can get it if you bring the cash. And so instead of going ahead and spending my day like I ought to, I tried to quit drinking that night. And my God, I like to fell apart. And I went back to see this brother that I put in business a long time ago. Well, he made money, and I knew he had money. And I went in there, and I went in and started telling him, most of it was lies, a little bit of the truth, what a nice restaurant it was and all this thing, building it up. And he said, Buck, I hope you can get it. I said, damn, if you ain't made a mess out of your life. And I said, well, the reason I'm down here is I want to borrow the money from you to buy it with. And he said, boy, anybody's made the money you made and throwed it away and neglected your family, I wouldn't let you have a damn nickel. And all I want to do is just get up and get out, you know. And I got up and started to walk out, and he said, Buck, if you ever decide to do anything about your drinking, I'll put you in any kind of business you want to go in and help you any way that I can. And why I said that, God only knows. I said, I don't think I'll ever take another drink of liquor as long as I live. And he said, wait a minute. And I turned around, and he pulled out a roll of money and started hulling it off, and I thought, my God, this thing's working. And he counted it out, and it said, want to know if there's anything else I need? And I said, no, that'll do it, boy. And I was grateful. I really was. I was a grateful human being right then. And he said, if you get back and need anything else, call me, and I'll help you out. Now, he took me serious that I wasn't ever going to drink no more. But from the time I left him and I started out that door, I thought, oh, boy, I put you in business, and you made this money and talked to me that way. You know what I thought? The hell with you. And I went straight to the liquor store and bought me a case of liquor and cussed him all the way back to Charlotte. And if I ever needed alcoholics in my life, I needed then and had never heard of AA. And, you know, the places I'd run, you'd thought somebody would have said something about AA, but they didn't. And, hell, I know why they didn't. They was all, when I come in AA, a bunch of them, my old drinking buddies was in here. So they just come and stay. They hadn't read about that last portion of the 12th chapter. We carry this message to them suffering alcoholics out there. But that was all right. It worked the way it's supposed to work. Went on back, and I got this little old place of business, and things did get better. I got to where I could drink good liquor again. My wife had a good job. She was working for an insurance underwriter, and things was going good so far as inside things. A man walked in one day, and he kept looking. You know, you can tell when somebody's looking you over, and I could feel that man looking me over. And after a while, I turned around, and he said, listen, I just bought a motel next door here and said, you look like a good operator. You know, when we buy half in a bag, sometimes we do operate pretty good. And he said, I'd like to hire you to operate it. And I said, man, I got a business here, you little old beer joint, you know. I got a business here. He said, yeah, but said, and I got a wife and three children. He said, well, you talk with your wife tonight and your children, and if you're interested, you meet me at 8 o'clock in the morning. So we've got nice living quarters and everything, and I'd like to hire you. He had asked me nothing about my drinking. And I said, okay, I might mention it to her. And, you know, I didn't mention it to her. I was on that telephone before that door slammed, telling her, I said, you tell me you ain't going to be at work tomorrow. We're going to get this job. But, you know, I'd lay around in motels drunk, and hell, I knew that wasn't a bad deal. And so the next morning we went out there, and that man hired me, the finest man I've ever worked for in my life. He hired me and paid me good, and for the next 4 years, my wife done a damn good job running that motel, too. I tell you. For my drinking, didn't get no better. But that's the time that I heard about AA. There's a bunch of us that meet down there every morning behind the old red barn, and we'd go up there. The law will lock you up if you stay on the river road down there, but if you get up behind there, they don't even bother you. And we get up there and tell lies. You know what drunks do, just lie and carry on all day and drink. And we got to missing an old boy one morning. Now, I'm going to talk to you all about attraction now. This guy, we got to missing old Percy. He just come up there, his seat out of his britches and dirty and everything, and we got to missing Percy. And one morning, I'd say, well, wonder where's old Percy at? Next morning, somebody said, well, wonder where's old Percy at? You know, they'll spend a quarter once in a while and call you, and if you miss AA enough, hell, we didn't. We just wondered about old Percy. And he never did show up. And so we had got back in business up there where we stayed for the next 23 years. And one morning I was sitting there in this car, a clean, shiny black car pulled in the driveway. And I thought, well, who in the hell is that? I was drunker than a cooter, and he pulled up, and it was Percy. And I said, my God, he's got a suit of clothes and a white shirt and a necktie on. And he stepped out of that car. Now, folks, that attracted me. But what I thought, Percy's got religion. I don't know. I always mix good things with church people. And Percy got out of the car and he said, Buck, you got any coffee? Shook my hand. Said, you got any coffee? And I said, yeah, I keep some instant in here for emergency. He said, that'll do. And I said, come on in. And he come in. I started making him a cup of coffee and poured me another drink. And he said, Buck said, I know some people can help you. I said, who are you talking about, Percy? He said, well, I know you're getting in jail. For see, I was had got started back gambling again. He said, I know you're getting in jail. And said, you're going to lose your wife and you're going to lose them three kids and you'll lose this business. And I thought he was talking about a banker. And I said, who are you talking about, Percy? He said, it's a group called Alcoholics Anonymous. And I said, you go to hell. Now, I know I had heard something about AA somewhere. I wouldn't have felt that way. And he pushed his coffee back and he said, Buck, if you ever decide to do anything about your drinking, call Alcoholics Anonymous. We're listed in the telephone book. And he walked out that door. And I was right then, I was glad he was gone. But Friday night when they took me down to the Mecklenburg County Jail, I'd have loved for Percy to come down there and talk to me for about 4 to 8 hours then. And that was my treatment center, was a county jail. And so he put a, I call it a booger on me that day. If I knew something had happened to Percy. And for that man was looking good. He was talking straight and everything. And ever I'd get in jail, I'd think, God, I wish I could call Percy. And, you know, he knows something. And so I kept on drinking, kept going. And then September 1967, the girl that was working there missed the bus. And I told Virginia, I said, I'll be back in a few minutes. I'm going to run Luella home. I don't know why I lay this watch down here. I can't see it no way. I'll quit when I get done. I told Virginia, I said, I'm going to run Luella home and I'll be back in a few minutes. And I was tanked up then, and I stopped and got me a supply of liquor and went on down to the road and let Luella out. And she got home the next day. Thank you. She got back to work the next day, and I didn't get back for 2 weeks. Thank you. And when I let Luella out, I kept going, and I ended up back down on that river walking and talking to myself. And I knew there was a better way to live than the way I was living. And I thought about AA a lot. And I ended up in a big poker game on a Thursday night. Now, I'd been down there just drunk for almost 2 weeks. And I ended up in a big poker game on Thursday night, and a man's wife broke it up. Now, if you don't believe a woman can break up a poker game, come in there stealing off of her husband, by God, and in her place of business, and she knowed where the gun was. And we got out in a hurry. But I knew where there was another big game at on starting the next day, and so I went up. I'd never been to this game before. And I went up there the next morning. I went in, and I got to talking to the guy, and I said, here, you got a big game going here. And I said, can I get in it? He said, hell, fella, I don't even know you. He said, this is a private game, and we don't let no strangers in. And he said, you can forget about that. And I said, would you like to have a little drink of this 100-proof Smirnoff? And he said, yeah, I sure would. So I poured him a big drink, and they had a couple of pool tables over there, and we got over, and I kept handing him a dollar once in a while, kind of setting things up. And after a while, I said, you ready for another drink? And he said, yeah, and I poured him another big drink. I knew what I was doing that morning. And so he downed it in a few minutes. I said, you reckon I can get that game tonight? He said, hell, Buck, I know you good enough. I'll set you right in. So and it does work at times like that. And that night, September the 21st, 1967, I was sitting there in that game, been knee-walking drunk for 2 weeks, and I had a glass of liquor sitting there on the table, and the cards had done been around. And I said to myself, oh, boy, if you're going to get this money, you better lay off of that liquor. And so far as I know, that's the last drink that I took. But I blacked out. I don't remember leaving that game that night. I drove 75 or 80 miles back down on Lake Wateree. And when I come to, I was sitting out beside under the pine tree there by the car, scared to death. I didn't know what I was afraid of. I had my pockets full of money, my shirt full of money, and was scared to death. And, I used to say I never had prayed, but every time I got in jail, I prayed. to get out. And, you know, then I'd get out and I'd think, hell, I'd have got out anyway. What'd I do that for? But I never thank God for getting me out of jail. But that night I got down and I prayed a sincere prayer and asked God to help me straighten my life out. Next morning when I woke up, I guess it was, or come to, the first thing that I thought about was Alcoholics Anonymous. I said, I'm going to call them. And I got in my car and drove 70 miles back to Charlotte. And when I pulled in the driveway, Virginia sitting there looking out the window. And, you know, I hadn't even thought of a lie to tell her where I'd been. She always wanted to know where you've been and who you've been with and what you've been doing. And I never did know half the time myself, no way. But I hadn't even thought of a thing to tell her that morning. And I got out and I walked in. And when I walked in the house, that woman says, good morning, Buck. Now, God had already took over at our house. You can bet on that. But, we'd been married 20 years, and when I'd come off of 2 weeks drunk, there wasn't no good morning, Buck. You can bet on that. So things was, there wasn't no reason. And I didn't want her to know that I was going to do something about my drinking. And I didn't mention nothing, didn't even look at the telephone or nothing. But I was wanting to call them. And after a while, she went in the other room, and I opened the telephone book, and the first two A's in the book, I dialed that number. The little lady said, my name's Betty. Can I help you? And I said, I hope so. I said, I want to do something about my drinking. And we talked a little bit, and she said, do you need somebody to come see you, or can you drive? And I said, yeah, I can drive. I got a 1951 Chevrolet. Fenders was all floppy and everything, but it'd run. And I said, I can get down there. And she told me where to come to. Said, come down to the club. There'll be somebody here to talk to you. And I got in my car, and I went down to the club that morning. And when I walked in the club, see, I still wasn't completely beat to death then. But when I opened the door, she said, hey, said, you must be Buck. And I thought, well, how did she know me? And, you know, I just got done telling her I'd been drunk for 2 weeks. Hell, she could have spotted me a mile away. But she said, come on over. I want you to meet Jim. Now, Betty forgot to tell me she was an alcoholic. And Jim said, I spoke to him, and he didn't say he was an alcoholic. He said, do you want to go to a meeting tonight? And I said, if that's what you do to quit drinking liquor, I do. He said, you be here tonight at 7 o'clock, and I'll take you to a meeting. And he thumped a dime down on that counter and said, gave me a cup of coffee, and he walked out. And I thought it was cold then. I still think it was cold. Hell, I had a pocket full of stole money, but, you know, he that dime supposed to have done something for me. It got me a cup of coffee. A dime cup of coffee is what it done. But I wanted to stay sober that day more than I wanted to drink. If I could have took a $20 bill and walked up to Coney Island beer joint there and threw it on the counter and made them winos that had a ball that day. But I wanted to stay sober. I went home and I got cleaned up and put on my best. And at 7 o'clock that night, I was sitting down in front of the club. And the man that was going to take me to the meeting, he pulled up in that big Chrysler Imperial. And he said, you ready to go, Buck? And I said, yeah. He said, well, come on. I said, no, sir. I done hitchhiked back from Myrtle Beach 3 or 4 times. You go off a bunch of drunks and hell, they'll leave you. And I wasn't... I wasn't about to take no chance, but I didn't know. The only man I'd ever met was an alcoholic, admitted, was Percy. And he told me he was an alcoholic, but Betty didn't tell me she was an alcoholic, and Jim didn't tell me. And by the way, I want to tell you, see, I had proof right away that this was a killer. Betty went back to drinking, and she took a .38 and blowed her brains out. Jim went back to drinking with 6.5 years sobriety, and he sat there in that rocking chair with a little dog on his lap for 3 weeks and just drank himself to death. So I had no doubt in my mind that it was a killer. And so, but he said, well, you come on and follow me. And I followed him over, and we pulled up in front of a Queen City group. It was meeting at the Baptist church there. And when we pulled up, I saw Irvin Hankins. Now, I ain't gonna break nobody's anonymity. Irvin's dead today. But run the largest funeral home in Charlotte. Now, anytime I'd ever see him, he's always in the Hamlets or a hearse one. And I thought, what in the hell is Hank doing here? I said, you know, I knew I was sick, but I said, I would look forward to really bring some sickens in there. And Hank come walking over the car, just trotted over. And I've always said that was a hand of AA. He had that hand out. He said, welcome, Buck. Said, I'm Hank, and I'm an alcoholic, and we need you here. And I thought, by golly, if he belongs to this outfit, it must be all right. And I'm going to go in and listen. And I went on in, and I went in and spoke to two or three guys. There was a little man sitting over there well, I sat about halfway up, and the man sitting across from me had on, looked like women, patent leather shoes on. They had snap on the side, and had a yellow coat with big black square checks on. He kept dinkling that foot there, and I kept wondering. I said, man, that's a wild looking dude, sure enough. But quick as, and the man went up and talked, and God, he just poured his heart out that night. He was John Hoppy, and John's dead today. And man, everything he talked about, I had done. But I'd be damned if I was ever going to tell it. I'll tell you that. And I said, my God, I can't believe that man. And he was president of a big gas company. And him up there talking that way, I said, man, I've done all them things. But and I did listen real good. I listened to every word that man said that night. And I believed him. And I could see honesty in that man. I knew he was telling the truth. I didn't have to question it at all. I knew he was telling the truth. And when he sat down, a man got up and he said, I'm going to offer the chips. If anybody here has a desire to quit drinking liquor, I'm going to offer you this desire chip. And I went up and I got that chip. And I come back and sat down. Everybody clapped their hands, and hell, nobody ever clapped their hands for me before, but it done me good that night. And I come back there and sat down, and they closed the meeting with the Lord's Prayer. And quick as they closed the meeting with the Lord's Prayer, I looked, and there that man with them patent leather shoes there had his arm around me. And he said, my name is Harry B., and I'm an alcoholic. I said, my name is Buck Melton, and I pick up a desire chip, so that makes me an alcoholic. Harry said, I love you, Buck, and God, I could have died. I looked down to see if I was unzipped or something, you know. But you know, the funny thing about that, 24 years later, Harry's still standing at that door every Monday and Friday night, and when a new drunk walks in, Harry hugs him and tells him, said, boy, I love you. That's staying with him. And I love Harry. Me and him laughs about that a lot, and I love him today too, and I tell him I do. But after I got away from Harry, another man walked over there and he said, you're sick, aren't you, boy? And I said, man, you don't know. He said, yes, I do. And if you want to get well, you stay here with us and we'll tell you how to do it. And you know, I take my hat off to all you old timers that was here and helped me, and I mean that thing. But that man, he knew what he was talking about, and he said, have you got $4 and a half? He didn't ask me if I'd stole it. I said, yeah, I got some money. He said, go over and buy you a big book. So it might be the best investment you ever made in your life. I went over and got me a big book and walked back. He said, when did you have your last drink? And I told him. He said, if you ever take another drink of liquor, as long as you live, you'll take it because you'd rather be drunk than to be sober. I said, how do you figure that? He said, we do this one day at a time, and you've done made 24 hours. So if you ever take another drink, it'll be because you'd rather be drunk than to be sober. He said, don't forget that. And so I had my big book, and I had Harry's telephone number, I know, and maybe another one. But I was as happy as I could be. And to tell you the shape I was in, I went out in the parking lot. Now, at one time, I drove a taxi in Charlotte. And I went out in that parking lot, and I couldn't even figure out how to get home. And there was a couple there that was in the meeting, and they said, aren't you the guy that picked that chip up there? I said, yeah. And they said, is something wrong? I said, yeah. I don't know how to get home. They said, where you live? And I told them. And they said, if we take you down to the Charlottetown Mall, could you get home from there? I said, yeah. And they said, follow us. And so we went down to Charlottetown Mall, and I got home. I knew, get my way around, my head kept clearing up, and I had my big book. And I'd met some people I liked, every one of them. And when I got home, though, I got, I can't take this in and tell my family I'm an alcoholic, wife and three kids. So I walked in and I dropped that big book in the clothes hamper and didn't know it. Hell, they after that I found out, they said he's done come home and changed clothes. He won't be back for 2 weeks. And so they went on to bed when I got home, and they could tell I wasn't drunk that night. And they went on to bed, and I went in there and I got the big book out and I started reading on the fly sheet. And I, by the time I had read through Bill Wilson's story, man, I knew that I was an alcoholic. There was no doubt in my mind. I knew it before that night when I prayed down in the woods, I knew it then. There was no doubt in my mind. But by the time I finished reading Bill Wilson's story, I thought, my God, you know, it's just like me. Like it, he's wrote about my life too. You know, he's on Wall Street and I'm on West Trade Street. But hell, we had the same feelings in here that all us Alkies have. And so I knew that this program would work for me. And that's when I started going to meetings. And everybody thought I had a sponsor in that group. But this man that took me over the first night, when they'd say the Lord's Prayer, he was gone. Boy, he'd get away from there. And so the night that I told Virginia she could go with me, I said, you know, as quick as I said, well, come on, I knew I'd played hell. I'd found a bunch of people I was happy with. I was sober for 3 weeks and things were going good. And I said, she'll go over there and screw the whole deal up. And, you know, and that's really the way I felt. I really did. And on the way, I said, I'm going to find me a sponsor. And so we got in, we opened our meetings, they asked for an announcement. I raised my hand. And they said, go ahead. And I said, I want to announce, I want me a sponsor. And everybody laughed. And I thought, you know, hell, I've done something wrong here again. And they said, no, said, we thought you had a sponsor. We want you to pick out somebody in this room that you like the way they're working the program, and ask them to help you. And we're going to give you some advice now. This is Harry B. again. He said, we're going to give you some advice. He said, pick out somebody that's got at least a year's sobriety. If you get somebody who's been here 3 weeks like you have, both of you might end up out there drunk. And I think that's some good advice he gave me that night. Well, this guy I was sitting beside, Wilson, who became my sponsor, and I want to say this, and if he had lived till July the 20th, he died March this year ago, if he'd lived till July the 20th, he'd had 50 years unbroken sobriety. Yes, sir, that's a long time between drinks. And so I asked him, I said, Wilson, would you help me with the program? And he said, Buck, I'll be glad to. He said, we'll talk after the meeting. Well, you know, I couldn't wait to, he didn't brag about his sobriety like we do today. And hell, I couldn't wait till after the meeting to find out how long he'd been sober. So I punched him. I said, Wilson, how long have you been sober? He said, Buck, I've been a member of Alcoholics Anonymous in good standing for 25 and a half years. I said, my God, man, you'll do. And, you know, he took me on, or I took him on one right then. And when the meeting was over that night, we went to his house, and we retook the first three steps of the program that night. And you know, I'd never helped nobody's hand and said no prayers. And you know, back then, they didn't even hold hands to close the meeting. And you know, and so I retook those steps. But I still say that night down in those woods was when I surrendered. I realized and accepted that I was powerless over alcohol. My God, and my life was unmanageable. You know, you could look at the back of my head or my police records, either one, and tell that my life was unmanageable. And so I watched the group, and all these guys that I used to sell liquor to was in there sober and happy. And I said, by golly, if they can do it, I can do it. And I come to believe that there was a power greater than me was doing for them what they couldn't do for themselves. And I said, if he'll do it for them, he'll do it for me. So I made that decision, and I turned my will and my life over to the care of God. And things began to change in my life. They've changed a little bit every day as I go along. And today I couldn't tell you what step I'm working on. It's a part of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous that I apply to my life every day. You know, and I don't think about other things. Well, I'm just an old AA member. And, you know, people say, well, how many meetings you go to a week? I don't go 7 or 8, you know, and probably don't need to go to maybe 1. But I don't know which nights I can miss. So I still go to 7 at least, or maybe 8. Well, I might miss the wrong night and take drunk, and I don't want that to happen. And so after I had accepted that everything was that this power of God, as I understand it, could and would take care of me, I went to work on a fourth step, sort of like probably some people might be in here tonight that's done it just the way I did. I put down what I wanted to put down on my fourth step. And it didn't do me a damn bit of good. That's just it. Didn't do me no good. I read it a time or two and got disgusted with myself, and I threw it away. And then I decided one day I'm going to try another one. And I put it out again. It wasn't completely honest. And my sponsor always taught me on the four absolutes: honesty, unselfishness, purity, and love. And he was one of them old boys that come up on that. And he talked about this honesty. And when I wasn't honest, it just get all over me, for I knew it. I didn't think nobody else did, but I did. And so one night I was sitting there and I said, you know, I'm going to do a four step. And I got on my knees and I prayed and I asked God to help me. And I started writing. And things come out. And when I finished that four step, I was ready to do a fifth step, something I said I'd take to my grave with me. And I'd seen an old boy do that too. And I think that's what scared me into going ahead and getting willing and do the fourth step. And so when I got it done, I called this preacher and asked him if he'd help me with I didn't call him. He come by and I asked him, a Presbyterian preacher. And I didn't want, you know, I figured I won't never see him again. And so I asked him and he said he would be glad to. And he come up there one day after church, after he'd preached a sermon. He was down at little place in South Carolina on the beach there, and he come up to Charlotte, and we went back, and I'd done a fifth step with that man, and you know, I used to wonder if I'd done it right. I must have done it right. I've never wanted to drink from that day to today. Thank God for that. And you know, he shared with me some of his, and that night when we was leaving, and I walked out of that door a free man. And I told him, I said, preacher, there ain't a whole lot of difference in me and you, except I drank liquor. You had a few damn defects, too. And he agreed with me on that. And he's worked with a lot of alcoholics since that day. But he pointed out, he kept diddling on a piece of paper there. And I thought, he's taking notes on me. And he said, no, I'm taking notes and things that'll help you later on. And what he was doing, he was writing down the people I needed to make amends to. And when I finished my fifth step and we talked, and he gave me this little piece of paper. He said, now a lot of them people that you think you need to make amends to, you really don't. You just want to make contact again. And so that rang my bell too, for he was telling the damn truth. And so I started making these amends, and I got them all made. The hardest amends I ever made was my wife and children. But I got my amends up, I thought, in order and lined up. And he said, I had it down where this last restaurant I'd had in South Carolina, I'd had a plumber to do a whole lot of work. And I didn't make no money, so hell, I just didn't pay him. I didn't figure I owed him. But I had it down on the list. And he said, what you going to do about that? And I said, oh, nothing. I said, that's been 15 years ago. He said, don't make no difference. How long ago it's been? If you don't do something about it when it starts bothering you, and he said, and it's going to start bothering you, you'll drink again. He didn't say you might drink again. He said you'll drink again. And I'd be damned if that won't put a booger on you folks. And so I'd go in, you know, and I made all these other amends and had everything just right. And I'd go in at night and I'd call myself doing the 10th step and I'd look my day over, you know, and I'd thank my God for a good day of sobriety and I'd go to bed and I'd put my head down on that pillar and that little voice would say, what you gonna do about that plumber? The devil won't drive you crazy. And I wrestled with that thing, and Virginia, I know she remembers the day it happened. I went to bed one Saturday night, and I thought I had done good that day, you know. And I could not go to sleep. And I said, God, if you'll let me sleep tonight, I'll pay that damn plumber tomorrow. I believe God gives us time to get our lives and things in order. And the next day I got up, and Virginia had to get up in the morning first, but she was up the next morning. And I said, I'm going to South Carolina. You want to go with me? And she said, yeah. We went down there. I knocked on that plumber's door. And he come to the door. Now, if you want to see somebody have a damn spiritual awakening, you go pay a plumber a bill that you owed him for 15 years. I guarantee you that. But it was good, and I paid the man, and when I got him paid, he wanted to know what had happened. He said, I knew when you left here that Christmas that things weren't going good for you. He didn't know how bad they were going when I left there. And I got to tell him about Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank God for that. And so those things were behind me, and I got my 10th, 11th, and 12th step to work and to maintain my sobriety today. And I think every day that... Every night, I can stop a lot of times during the day when I've harmed somebody or done something wrong. It don't hurt me to say I'm sorry today. Used to, I could take a resentment to almost to my grave with me and never did forget nothing. You know, I'd go burn your barn in a minute if you done me wrong, but I don't have to do that no more. and it's good to go in and look my day over and thank my God for a good day of sobriety. and this way of life, this way of life. And I know how to pray. And God, you know, every once in a while I pray for me a drunk, and I get one. And we don't get the calls like we used to, for that we get them now to take them to treatment centers. But I like to get a call, and this past year I've got a hold of me two brand new real drunks. And you know, I'd almost, it'd been a while since I got a real off the street drunk. And to get one and get down and take these steps and lead them through the steps and see them get sober. And you know, it tells us we have a group of friends that grew up around us, and this is it today. And I'm a member of the Fundamental Group in Charlotte, North Carolina. I'm an active member there. If you're coming through Charlotte, I'm listed in the telephone book. If you call AA Answering Service and ask them if they know an old boy named Buck, I'll guarantee you they can give you my number if I go to meetings. And I've worked with these two guys, and you know, to see them go back and make amends and their families get together and straighten out. And we've got these three children. They're grown and gone now, and they're on their own. But to have a place when the two got sick, they could come back and be there, the mother be there and take care of them. And you know, she enjoyed that more than anything she's done many years. I like to watch her. Else, you know, I'd sit down and say, well, my God, she ain't brought me no coffee in the morning. But she was, you know, I could dwell on that thing a little bit, and I'd get me a quickie of resentment. But they're getting along good, and I love them, and I got my self-respect back. I feel good about myself today. And they treat me like they're really proud that they got a daddy that's sober today. And me and my brothers, we all, there's six of us boys and one girl still living. We get along good. You know, I'd been sober 10 years, and my sister called me and said, well, let me tell you about this. It's been going a long time. But they called me about a month or so ago and said, Buck, what you going to be doing on the 12th of December? I said, God, I don't know why. They said, well, if you're going to be gone somewhere, we can change, but we're going to have a family Christmas party, and we want you and Virginia to be there. I said, well, let me get my calendar out. I said, we're going to be home on the 12th. They said, okay. But the way this thing got started, I'd been sober 10 years, and my sister called me and said, Buck, we're having a little Christmas party down here, and said, we'd love for you and Virginia to come down to it. I said, good, we'll be there. We went down to the party, had a good time, all my brothers and their wives, and we changed the little gifts, and everything went good, and we got in the car and started back to Charlotte that night, and I told Virginia, I said, now, you know, next year, if somebody else don't have it at their house, we'll have it at our house. I said, hell, this is good. I enjoyed it and had fun. Good to be with my brothers and sisters. She said, well, I'm going to tell you something, but I don't want you to get too bad of resentment about it. And I said, what's that? She said, hell, Buck, they've been having that for 10 years. They just now figure you're going to stay sober. And you know, I believe that we have to prove it. We have to prove our sobriety to some people. For we've lied and cheated and stole so long. Hell, they don't believe it. I made some amends. I could tell you some amends, and I know I got to sit down. But I could tell you some amends that I made to my brother. I stole a boat one time. My brother was in the insurance business, and he had to pay for the boat. See, I done took that boat back to North Carolina. I'd stole it down on Lake Watereath. What happened? They had a flood, and the boat washed up in my yard. That sounds good, don't it? What really happened, I did tow it up a little bit, you know. And that boat lay there, and everybody claimed, I must have had a dozen boats or more there. Everybody claimed the boat but that one. It was a new fishing boat. And I said, boy, if the sun goes down, I'm going to take that thing to Charlotte. And the sun went out, and nobody hadn't claimed it, and I loaded that on a trailer, and that was just before I got sober, and I put that in the garage, and I didn't tell nobody about it. I was afraid to take it out when my brother found out he had his company had to pay for the boat. And so anyway, what I ended up talking to my sponsor, and he said, what you going to do with it? And I said, God, I don't know. What you think I ought to do? He said, well, if it was me, I'd take it back and put it in the lake. I didn't tell him that my brother done paid for it. So one night I put it on the boat, and I took it back down that lake, and when I backed down that ramp, I burnt the wheels coming out, but that damn boat went all the way across that lake, I think. And my brother's got him a nice fishing boat now. But I went But I went back, honest to God, I went back to make amends to him, and I told him what I'd done, and I'd done it. And he said, "Buck, you know you didn't." I said, "I know I did." He said, "I know you didn't." I said, "I've done the best I can. Let's forget it then." But he's got him a nice fishing boat today. You know, but we have to prove to people that we really mean business. And when I come into AA, you know, I didn't come here to get the monkey off my back. I come here for I was hurting inside, and I knew that I had to change the way that I was living. And by the grace of God, I've got 2 days, 2 months, and 24 years of good living. I feel good about myself. Me and that woman, hell, we still fight. We had a pretty good week this week. Next week will be better. I love her more today, I guess, than I ever did. And I get, hell, if you just keep on fighting, you got to love one another to hang in 45 years. And I do love her, and I love my kids, and I feel good about myself. And as I said, if I could just stay with you people all the time, it would be all right. But I know I got to go back out in this world. And when we leave here from this good weekend, you know, if we'll trust God and try to help others, things are going to be all right. And I love you, and thank you all for letting me come.